listening to The After Show, the bonus episode series for On Tour with Brian Ray. This is a production of iHeartRadio and Black Barrel Media, and I'm your host, Mandy Wimmer. In The After Show, we dive a little deeper into Brian's thoughts about certain parts of the interviews, as well as expound a bit more on his own experiences on tour. In this episode, we get into Brian's personal Toto story involving a hot tub and the song Rosanna. We hear what bands really go through to come up with the perfect name, the story behind Brian's so-called little audition at the Super Bowl with living legend Paul McCartney and 100 million people watching on television, and the breaking points both he and Steve had that led them into sobriety. Here's my conversation with Brian Ray. Brian, how are you today?
Hey, Mandy, how are you? I'm just great. Seems like forever.
Right? I mean, yeah. How do you feel? We are fully on tour now. We are at stop three of the tour with now Steve Lukather.
We are, yeah. It's just the train keeps a rolling.
So, Steve, my God, I mean, what an amazing career and very, very long career. I mean, 45 plus years in the industry. You guys started when you were babies with Marie and Cherie Curry. Just too crazy. Steve was the boyfriend, as he talks about, and you came in to play guitar. So all of a sudden now there's three guitar players. I mean, any crazy stories from those days? Yeah, you guys didn't really get into that.
I was just back from a long stay in Switzerland where I had been living sort of for 6 months, and I had been getting over an injury to my arm and now finally had mobility and I was ready to play and didn't know exactly what I was going to do next. And I got a call from my friend Joey Brassler saying, hey, would you join me and Steve Lukather with the Curry sisters, Marie and Cherie Curry?
And you knew of Steve at that point.
Of course, yeah. Right. And I loved my buddy Joey, and I think I had met Steve Lukather before. But in any case, I took a second to think it over and then said, yes, I'd love to do that. And so we put this band together, Steve Lukather being the boyfriend of Marie Curry at the time. I don't think they were married yet. And it was going to be like a wall of guitars, three guitar players up front shredding away, you know, with our crazy hair flying, you know. Back when all the drugs were working, you know, and, you know, back in the day, it was such
setting the scene.
Yeah, it was such a fun time. It wasn't a big venue tour. It was like clubs, but they were hot off a new album. And it was just terrific fun, just wild.
Yeah. I would love to have been a fly on the wall with you and Steve Lukather in your heyday on that tour.
There's a picture somewhere of at least Joey and I up front shredding away. And I'll see if we can get that. I've asked Joey for it. Get it out there on social media.
Oh, my God. Maybe thank God social media wasn't around during those days.
Probably for the best it wasn't around. I mean, you really don't want to know.
Well, so moving on from Marie and Cherie Curry, a huge band, Toto. I mean, so many amazing hits. Yeah. I love Toto, Africa, Rosanna. I mean, some of these mega hits. Steve being a founding member, the Porcaro brothers, you know, back in high school. I mean, they just did amazing sessions, all these huge hits. What were your thoughts on this band at that time?
Well, so as a musician, we were very all aware of the Porcaro brothers, right. You know, and Lukather and David Paich and these guys who were huge, as you said, session masters,
right.
You know, getting all the calls for Quincy Jones and for everybody. And, you know, word got out that they were doing sort of a super band out of this group of great accomplished session guys. And there wasn't a bad singer or writer among them.
No.
They're just terrific. And it's so funny. I remember I was on a getaway, as I often do, getaway, as often as possible, getaway. I was out in Desert Hot Springs at this little place called Two Bunch Palms that I've been going to since forever. And I was in the mineral springs, you know, the natural mineral springs. It's 104 degrees. And you're like, ah, a nice autumn day. And this woman comes into the mineral bath, and we start a little conversation, and she, you know, we're just chatting away. She goes, oh, my boyfriend just wrote a song for me. I just came from the studio, and I have a rough mix of it. And I go, oh, that's great, amazing.
Why are you telling me this?
I think that I'm about to hear it. Anyway, she runs off to get her Walkman, because that's what we were listening to back then, and her little, you know, headphones, and brought them into the side of the mineral pool. And she gives me the headphones. I put it on, and here comes this song, Rosanna.
What?
Yeah, it was Rosanna Arquette, and she is playing me this new song by Toto. And I'm listening to it. I'm going, oh my God, this is amazing. This is like a spectacular movie for your ears. And I remember thinking, I don't think it's a single, but but it's terrific.
Hey, so maybe your instincts were a little off on that one.
Yeah, maybe just a little bit. Now, what do I know?
So who was her boyfriend?
Steve Porcaro.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Wow, what a small world. So when you listened to it, did you know this is Steve Porcaro, this is Toto, or had you?
Yeah.
Okay.
I put it all together at that point.
Okay. Yeah. All right. How cool.
Yeah.
What a crazy story. So one of the funniest stories I think that Steve tells in this interview is the naming of the band Toto. I mean, again, I'm not going to do it justice. You just got to go listen to his version of the story. It's hysterical, but it definitely raises the point that naming bands is hard. Naming bands, naming companies, naming anything is challenging. I mean, it's something you're stuck with forever. You have to love it. I mean, it's really hard to figure out, does no one else have it? Does it sound like this? You know, your band, the Bayonets, do you guys have any great stories about how did you come up with it?
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, it's so true. It's one of those things that you look forward to and you sort of cringe at having to do, naming your band.
Right.
Because you want it to sort of, you know, portray the feeling, characterize what it is that you're doing in some kind of way. And the problem is that it always devolves into ridiculous hilarity. And in the case of the Bayonets, my band with my buddy Oliver Lieber, currently on hiatus, our naming went on for months months of late night texts sending back and forth the dumbest, funniest, dirtiest things you've ever heard. It's just back and forth and back and forth, laughing our asses off for the longest time until I said, look it, man, this is really funny, but we got to find a name.
We got to do this now.
Yeah, and I heard a speech by our former president, Barack Obama.
Uh-huh.
It wasn't a speech, actually. It was in the debates.
Oh, okay.
And he was replying to Mitt Romney, who he was interacting with, and said something about Mitt Romney tried to get in a crack about war.
Mm-hmm.
And said, you don't need these, you know, this or that, or you need more of this and that. And Barack Obama says, well, we don't really need bayonets and horsemen. You know, he was making the point that, you know, we're fighting a different war now.
Right.
And I just thought, bayonets and horsemen, great band name.
Right.
So we just shortened it down to the Bayonets. And so, there you go.
That's amazing. And did you, when you texted it to him, was he like, that's it? Or was there some convincing?
I think, yeah, I had to lobby him for a little while. I hired some lobbyists, you know, bought him a lunch and lobbied him.
Well, you won. Good job.
At a certain point, I just said, you know, this is the name.
Yeah, we just got to do
this. This is the name.
Yeah, no, we're done. We're done with this.
Yeah.
So when you guys are on tour, you guys are human, right? You're traveling. You're in close quarters. You know, there's people get run down. You're going from stop to stop, city to city. You're around a million people. Clearly, you get sick. This is what happens. Mm. And Steve talks about, again, hysterical story of when he got food poisoning on stage. And you've told the story before as well about when you had food poisoning on stage and you got through it. Steve, unfortunately, has to run off of stage. And it's completely hysterical. Again, something that you have to listen to. But that happens. You know, people get sick, you know, and if you're not the front man of a band and they're not necessarily going to cancel the show for you, or maybe sometimes they have to, you guys don't have understudies. This isn't Broadway. Mm-hmm. How does that work?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. It's a miracle that tours aren't canceled more often because somebody got very ill.
Right.
And it's a miracle that so many shows in a tour go off without a hitch in terms of the band, you know?
Right.
And in the case of our band with Paul McCartney, it's been nearly 20 years. And in 20 years, we only canceled one show and we came and made it up later. And
was it because someone got sick?
Or? No, Paul got a laryngitis.
Oh, okay.
And he came in and tried. We played the sound check, and he just wasn't feeling like he could put his best show forward. So he wisely pulled the plug, and they understood. We came back and made it up. In the case of me, I was playing with Etta James, and the only show I've ever missed was just one that got written down incorrectly. And she calls me from Santa Barbara, 2 hours north of LA, going, "We're on in a half hour and you're not here yet."
So you just wrote down the wrong date.
And I turned white as a ghost, whiter than I already was. And it just felt terrible. And anyway.
Wait, so were you sick or you just got the date wrong?
We got the dates wrong. We just got communication wrong. And that was a tough one to bear. But like Steve did, I got food poisoning on stage once, as I said in our episode. And man, I don't know how I got through that, but they propped me up on a bar stool and I just, played through that. But I got very, very ill.
So in terms of Etta, so did they play the show without you then?
They did.
Just had to go on with, there was one other guitar player? Or?
No, I was usually the only guitar player in her band and the musical director.
Okay.
So, there was a sax player who played organ and sax and sang a lot, and a second keyboard player. So they probably just did a whole lot of keyboard and sax solos all night.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Wow. That's nuts.
Yeah.
That's, awesome for her to be able to kind of keep going through all of that.
But sure.
I guess the show must go on.
Yeah. The show must go on. And Etta James is not, doesn't have a lack of ability to carry a show,
Right. Of course. So in talking about people that carry shows, the Beatles, there's something about the Beatles that I am completely fascinated by. And that is that they are still today legends, and they are, and some of them living legends, of course. Well, everybody in the world knows the name, the Beatles, and they were only together for 8 years. And Steve talks about this, the canon of music that was left by the Beatles and the legacy that was left by the Beatles and only being around for 8 years.
Yeah, I mean, they did start out earlier than that. Mm-hmm. That's 8 years with the name The Beatles.
Right.
But before that, they were, the Silver Beatles, and they had a few iterations.
Oh, they were. Interesting.
Yeah, but that final lineup with that name, recording as that band with that name, was 8 years. And it's remarkable. You're right. I mean, they're not just legends. They're the biggest act ever.
Right.
There will never be another band that has the kind of socioculture impact that they had. It's just, it's not going to happen again. And it is remarkable that in that brief period of time, they left such a mark for generations to come. Look out in the audience and you'll see an older gentleman with, his grandchild on his shoulders singing every word. And she's like 4. And then you go like, oh my God, their future is safe because these kids want to know the songs.
Right. That's it. And I've been to a few of the shows and it is remarkable. You do see people of all ages who absolutely love the music.
Yeah.
It's a huge compliment to the Beatles. Now, sessions. So this is something I wasn't as familiar with until we had this conversation with Steve. And he has been on some mega hits, the Thriller, Beat It, Lionel Richie. I mean, you name it. Steve Lukather, there's probably been a part of it. I mean, the one question on that is that, just explain to me, and maybe this is naive, but you have guitar players playing in the sessions that are not necessarily part of the touring band. So they're not playing the shows live, right? So they're playing in the studio album, but they're not playing the show live. So how does that work?
Well, I mean, it's sort of two different career paths.
Okay.
You're a studio musician because of the skill set that you've honed, or you've concentrated more on touring and playing live with a certain, identified with a certain artist, like I was with Etta James.
Mm-hmm.
And often those meet. And as the case was with Etta James, I started recording with her a year after I got with her and did my first album with her in Fort Lee, New Jersey, at Chess Records. And there was the band already built in, and I was the only white guy. And, amazing. You know, so you kind of learn quickly how to adapt. And then 2 years after that, I was recording a new album with Etta James with the great Jerry Wexler producing.
Right.
There in Los Angeles with some of the biggest names in recorded music alongside of us. Jerry Wexler, of course, with Aretha Franklin fame. You know, he produced Respect, you know.
Right, right. Oh, my gosh, huge. Yeah. Are there any sessions that you've been involved in that we wouldn't know, kind of like Steve?
Oh, tons.
Really?
But if you'll all go to, I think it's called allmusic.com.
Okay.
They've done a really good job of categorizing and noting everyone's accomplishment anywhere. If you're anybody, it's in there.
Really?
Yeah.
And what is allmusic.com?
Yes.
You just look up the person, you can see all the songs they've been a part
of. Yes, go to allmusic.com and search your pal, whoever that is.
Oh my gosh, that's super cool. Okay, I'm doing that before our next after show.
Yeah.
We're going to have more to talk about on that. okay, so you and Steve also have a kind of an interesting connection in the fact that Steve snubs the king of pop, Michael Jackson, in a super awkward way. And it is so funny. And you had a very similar experience with Paul. You had your audition show at the Super Bowl, and then he kind of welcomed you to the team after that show. You went home to cram all the music and get ready for mm-hmm. tour. And all of a sudden you get a phone call from Paul McCartney mm-hmm. and you do not believe it's him. Clearly you were not expecting the phone call. So give us a little insight into what you were thinking.
Yeah. Well, I mean, honestly, no one's expecting a phone call from Paul McCartney, you know, just as Stephen wasn't expecting a call from Michael Jackson. But yeah, the phone rings. I'm at home and there's a voice that comes on. Hi, Brian. I go, hello. He says, hi, it's Paul. And I went, Paul who? And he goes, you know, Paul, the bass player. And I go, Paul, he goes, Paul McCartney. And I go, no way. And so, he just laughed so hard. And he handed the phone to John, his assistant, and they just laughed for about 5 minutes.
So what was he calling for?
Just to say he was loving watching some video we had just recorded. It was very early days.
Oh, that's so cute. Yeah. He called you personally to tell you that.
Yeah.
Oh, I love that. So your audition with him was the Super Bowl. I honestly don't know if there is a bigger audition known to man. I mean, you have 60, 70, 80,000 people in the audience that are there live. Mm-hmm. And then you've got 100 million people watching on TV. Mm-hmm. And you are next to this living legend, Paul McCartney, singing Beatles songs. This is the first show that you've ever done with mm-hmm. him. Did you meet him before you went on stage?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. I mean, you guys had rehearsed and everything, correct? Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, but how was that to step on stage with him? How much pressure's on you? And what are you thinking before you? What song did you play, first of all?
It's a song called Freedom.
Okay.
And it was a song from his album called Driving Rain.
Okay.
And I mean, no pressure at all, right? Just 100 million people worldwide, at least.
Right.
And 77,000 in the stadium. And it's my audition. It's going to be my first time, you know, being seen with Paul McCartney. And now I had told a group of my friends that I was about to do this. But there's nothing that can take away the sort of sheer, you know, impact that this is about to happen, you know. And so we did it, and it kind of went like a dream, you know. It's like 4 minutes or whatever. And
do you remember any of it?
Sure, I do.
Wow,
yeah,
nice.
I do. And then I remember we were all sort of whisked off to go up to a skybox to watch the rest of the game. Well, to watch the whole game. This was pre-show 2002, before the national anthem, mm-hmm. one song.
Right, right.
And we later came back to do the halftime show. That's a separate thing. This was 2002, earliest of days, my very first thing. We come back up, go up to our skybox, and we're watching the game, and Paul's sitting up there, and the rest of us are scattered in those little seats that they have in front of a skybox, and we're watching the game, and I'm going like, that just happened. Oh my God, that's so cool. Then you walk up and you start socializing, and here comes Winona Judd, and Paul's chatting with her, and then I pop by and he called me, Brian, come here, and introduces me to Winona and her great red hair flaring. And he said, Winona, this is Brian, and this is his little audition. And I said, yeah, this is my little audition, just my little intimate audition.
Before you go on stage at the Super Bowl, what is going through your mind?
I mean, your mind is racing.
Yeah,
obviously.
Right. You know, your mind, your heart, everything. Did you have anything you did for good luck before you went on stage, or was it everything was moving too fast?
I cried. No, not at all. I will actually go pray.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's something mm-hmm. that has guided me and helped me through sometimes. It's just, right. you know, a way to reset and connect with right. something other than your own imagination. You know what I mean?
Do you do that? Is that kind of your pre-show tradition? Do you do that before every show?
Off and on.
Yeah.
Not all the time.
Yeah. So you and Steve also really get into sobriety. Really, Steve talks very candidly about how alcoholism, drug use almost ruined his career. And the sobriety really, he credits with saving his career, that he was squandering his career. People were calling him out. He was super puffy when he looked in the mirror. He couldn't look at himself. He was day drinking. He's very open about this in the interview. And you ask him, was there a breaking point? Mm-hmm. Was there that point where he just said, all right, enough is enough? You obviously have a sobriety story as well that you've spoken openly about. Was there a breaking point for you?
Yeah, you know, it's similar to Steve in that I was having a great career and I had not blown my career. Mm-hmm. But I knew that things were not going as well as they should. And I was I was having a really bad day. I had blown up my car. I had pissed someone off. You know, I'd really done the trifecta.
Right,
you know,
right.
Blow up your car, piss off a friend, you know, someone cancels on you.
Right.
And I was just feeling really sorry for myself and called a friend of mine named Katie, who is a very big actress and an old friend of mine that I went to junior high with. And I was, you know, telling my story of woe, you know, woe is me. And she goes, after a little while, she goes, okay, well, I got to go. I'm going to a meeting. And it's like 6:30 at night. What kind of meeting are you going to at this time?
Right.
She said, well, I'm going to a 12-step meeting. And I said, whoa, wow. I didn't know that you needed that. And she goes, well, I don't know that I do either. I'm 30 days sober and I like how it feels. And I went, well, I'll come along with you and support you at this new thing. You know, come to find out, she was tricking me into going
right.
because she could tell I could use it. And
right,
I went
right.
and that was the end of it for me.
Wow.
Crazy thing. I didn't finish the joint when I got home. Never finished the joint.
You left mid-joint.
I'm left mid-joint.
Wow. Yeah. You came home and you threw it away and you never looked back.
It actually stayed in my drawer for a little while, just as a little, you know, a safety, a comfort.
Just in case.
Just in case just things in case. Got wild.
Wow.
Yeah, I stuck it out, man.
And so how many years?
I just celebrated 34 years. Yeah.
Congrats. Mm-hmm. Amazing.
Well,
that's a huge accomplishment.
Well, you know, I wouldn't be doing things that I'm doing at the level I'm doing them if I would have continued the way I was going.
Right. Yeah. The handwriting was on the wall.
Yes. That not just handwriting. There was a lot of things on the wall.
That's for another after show.
Yes.
All right. So we are going to wrap it up with the audience questions and our lightning round. So we had a lot of great audience questions again, and please also keep them coming. So we are going to keep ticking them off during every after show. One that I thought was really interesting is when you guys are out, you tour with a Beatle, with a former Beatle, Paul McCartney. And one of the questions was, why do you never play the Beatles' guitars on tour?
Mm. Well, I play guitars that work for the song to my ears.
Okay.
Also, we are famously not a karaoke band. So there's
right.
a lot of bands out there doing tribute that do it very well. Lots of them. All
right.
over the world. We've seen one in Japan.
Yeah.
Japanese guys.
That did Paul McCartney tribute?
That do a Beatles tribute.
Beatles tribute. Okay.
And they'll play all the guitars for the various eras of the Beatles. And there were many of the guitars and basses and drums they used back then. And it just isn't really our choice. Also, you know, that's not the point. It's
right.
more the point to sort of approximate the tone and bring it to life. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not a museum. It's it. These are living, you know, breathing arrangements by living men on stage playing the songs in real time.
And so you guys are ad-libbing on stage a lot of the time, or is it, I mean, you're obviously very well rehearsed, but do you kind of do different things during different shows, or how does that go?
Well, sure. To an extent, we're humans, you know, right. And Paul is very in the moment. At the same time, the songs are sort of sacrosanct. You know, mm-hmm. there is a great deal of reverence and respect for these songs and every hook embedded inside. Well, us Beatle fans, we
love
would
it.
Hang on to every single note and everything.
All 60,000 people in the audience are hanging on to that.
Yeah, and they want to hear their memories delivered in the way that resonates with them.
Right.
So we appreciate that. We're reverent, but we're also humans. So
right.
Paul might, you know, play a little different guitar lick, and that might make me play a different, you know, bass lick.
Right.
And it's on like that. And, but you know, the background vocals and many of the solos are sort of note for note because
right.
you really want to serve up what people are used to.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that makes total sense. And one person asked about rituals and traditions pre-show, which we really kind of already talked about, unless you have anything else.
Oh yeah. So, well, you know, Paul will often come to the dressing room and we'll just hang out and do a little bit of singing and stuff like that. But, you know, if you've ever seen any DVD of us live, you'll see some of that included.
Right, right.
Yeah, and I pretty much stay away from talking about all the details. But yeah, there's a lot of information out there on that stuff.
Okay, so last audience question for today is your early inspirations. You have talked about the Beatles and Elvis, but I know you've also talked about, you know, blues,
mm-hmm.
and how you, like, that's really where rock and roll began. So any other early inspirations, you know, your favorite blues artists or anyone else besides the Beatles or Elvis that really kind of inspired you?
Well, it's interesting. I discovered rhythm and blues music and doo-wop music from a pirate radio station blasting out of Tijuana, Mexico, with this wild DJ who had this great personality, and he had this wolf call going on in the background, all echoey, you know, and I'm going, oh my God, who is this freaky guy? You know, really intriguing, really compelling. It was Wolfman Jack.
Oh,
who
wow.
Went yeah. on to be a huge star. And he liked that music. He didn't play a whole lot of the sort of more white pop. He didn't play a lot of the sort of manicured, produced, you know, pop of the era. He tended more towards rhythm and blues and R&B, doo-wop. And he was serving up something on that radio station that really caught fire for me.
Mm-hmm.
And it would sort of light my soul to go back and look at the music that had informed people like the Beatles, the Stones,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that was, you know, my favorites like Albert King and B.B. King and Otis Rush and Bobby Bland and all these great musicians, Howlin' Wolf,
nice.
You know, all of these guys that really built the foundation that rock and roll was built upon, you know, and
wow.
Obviously Chuck Berry.
Right, right. Of course. Yeah. I hear yeah. you talk about Chuck quite a bit. Very nice. Well, so the lightning round, okay. Again, do we remember one is music and one is not music?
Okay.
And
so if you say so.
It's very serious.
Don't get mad.
There's no thinking.
Okay.
And number one. Music question. You are not just a guitar player. You write and you sing as well. And your music gets played often on the Underground Garage, Stephen Van Zandt's Sirius radio station. So my question to you is, of all of your original music that you have created, which currently is your favorite?
Well, it's funny you should ask that question right after me telling the story about Wolfman Jack, because I have a song called Pirate Radio.
Oh.
Which is, I guess, about a year old now,
mm-hmm.
that is on Wicked Cool Records, that Little Steven played a lot on the radio station. And then a more recent one called Got a New Thing. So those mm-hmm. would be my two favorites, if I'm allowed to. Those are the two.
Not really. That's kind of cheating, but it's already out there. So
it's already out there. Yeah. Can't put it back in the tube.
We're going to let this slide this week, but next week, no, that's not going to happen.
Okay.
All right. So Next question has nothing to do with music. Professionally, if you were not a musician, what would you be?
That's a great question. Well, I love architecture and that kind of thing. So I would probably be an architect, except that would require a ton of schooling. And I don't want to go back to school. So I'm just going to stay into music.
Are you sketching around the house at all? Like practicing just as a hobby?
No, I just take it in. You know, we're out here in the desert right now in Palm Springs. And there's so much great sort of cutting edge mid-century architecture that's original, mm-hmm. that's, you know, very much appreciated here and conserved. You know, there's a great conservation move out here. And I just love that stuff. Yeah.
Awesome. Love it. All right. Well, that wraps up week three of the tour. We will see you next week.
Sounds good. I'll be here.
Thank you, everyone, for listening. On Tour and The After Show are productions of iHeartRadio and Black Barrel Media. This show is produced by me, Mandy Wimmer, with executive producer Noel Brown. For more information about On Tour, visit our website, blackbarrelmedia.com. For behind-the-scenes photos from these interviews and to interact with us, visit our social media at On Tour on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. For more shows from iHeartRadio and Black Barrel Media, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.